Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Ethics Talk. My name is Hope May, and I'm joined tonight by Erica Maley.
Hello.
Jeffrey Lambert.
Hi, everybody.
And Michael Russo.
Hello.
So, welcome, everyone, to our second pass at Tolstoy's Why People or Why Men. I can't figure out which is their true title. Stupefy Themselves, which is a continuation of our show last week. We are focused on Tolstoy's essay, and you can access this at our show resources page, ethicstalk.cmich.edu. And before I set up the show, I just wanted to mark today as my wedding anniversary. And the reason why I'm doing that is twofold. One is that at some point in the future, I will be listening to this and I'll be like, huh, that was my wedding anniversary back then. But also because the group of students that's here tonight, Erica and Jeff, came into my life because of The Hague and the International Criminal Court, and I just wanted to pay homage to the connection here because the International Criminal Court was my honeymoon destination. And so this time, 3 years ago, I had never been, and of course, we're all here now. And so happy anniversary to me and Jeffrey.
Yes, happy anniversary and congratulations.
Thank you very much. And and Mike, that was the last time I saw you, was it not, at the wedding?
I believe it could have been.
Yeah, it was 3 years ago, although it's my fourth anniversary. That's a topic for another show. So getting back to the topic, which is Tolstoy. Right, so in a nutshell, Tolstoy says, thou shalt never ever drink. He also says, thou shalt never ever smoke anything. no drinking, no smoking, never. And we, like last week, are focused on just alcohol in this show, and we're going to try our best to keep the conversation tailored to alcohol use in college and try to bring Tolstoy's arguments to bear on the experiences involving alcohol in college. So that is where we're going tonight, and to just get the conversation going, I'm going to just ask this general question, and I'll start with you, Erica. Why do you think drinking is so prevalent and ubiquitous in college?
Okay, I have a couple different ideas about why it is so prevalent in college, and the first one I would say is just people want to see what it is and they experiment with it. They might not have tried it in high school, but they get to college and they're away from home and they're going to try something new. Another thing is that I think people are kind of searching for who they really are, finding out what their interests are and who they are as a person and what they believe. But they want acceptance at the same time. They're in a new place, they want new friends, and they want to be part of something. And I feel like a really easy way to fit into a group is to go to a party or go out, because that's something that a lot of college students already do, and it's something that you can talk about with somebody or be with them. And so I feel like that happens a lot when students want acceptance. And then I think later on in college, maybe once you've already made friends and stuff, going out is an escape from the stresses of class and work. So those are a few reasons.
Wow, great. Jeff, what about you?
I agree with all those. And I think the part about fitting in, I mean, that really is expanded upon because I think it's a social expectation to drink when you're out. It's not people on the one side maybe feel like drinking helps them fit in, but then on the flip side, once you're drinking, those who aren't drinking don't fit in. So it goes twofold. And I just think that's a big, big part of drinking in college is the social expectation. And it's not even just drinking, but it's drinking a lot and, you know, like partying hard, especially on the weekends. And I think that goes, rings true to Erica's point about getting away from the stresses of class and work. As we touched on last show, we said that intellectual work is very hard, and Tolstoy actually says it's harder than physical work. So I think that a lot of times when the weekend rolls around, a lot of college students are like, okay, I've had enough. Hopefully they've been studying hard and doing all of the necessary reading and preparations for class, and so the weekend comes around, and then they view alcohol, as Erica put it, as their escape. But I also think, I kind of touched on it last time, and Tolstoy touches on it in his piece, that people purposely drink to put themselves in a situation where they can do things that they normally wouldn't do. And I think that that rings true in college a lot as well. You know, people maybe feel reserved. I mean, it goes on very minuscule levels, like dancing or talking to new people, you know. People think, okay, we'll have a few drinks and it'll make that easier. But then there's also, like, you know, meeting people of the opposite sex and also getting into fights a lot. I feel like there's so many fights on a college campus, and it all comes back to alcohol. And it's like people are purposely putting themselves in a position where they can say, oh, well, no, that really wasn't me because I was drinking. Hmm. And so it's almost like purposely putting themselves in that state so they can fall back and have an excuse for normally unacceptable behavior from a sober individual.
Great. Mike, what about you? Why do you think drinking is so ubiquitous in college?
Well, I suppose I would have to agree with what has been said so far, and what can I say? The college students speak. I mean, they have just told us why. They would know, I guess, since they know, you know, their peers and so forth, and it sounds right anyhow to me. I think there might be, you know, I guess we would have to ask, like, as Tolstoy seems to suggest when he starts his piece, that, you know, there are a lot of things people say about why they drink to, like, enjoy themselves and so forth, but there's really, like, a deeper reason that's involved. And so, I mean, supposedly, you know, Tolstoy's answer that it's to, like, deaden the conscience is deep and profound. It's like a one answer for all contexts, and maybe that, like, oversimplifies it somewhat, but you know, there might be different reasons and different circumstances, whatever, but in general, I think personally, and I think it relates to what Tolstoy is saying, but it's slightly different, and draws from, if we relate it to his paper here, on page 3 on the PDF, a section that you read last time on the air when you talked about this before.
Oh, you were listening last week?
Yeah, I called in and talked.
I know.
Okay.
The voice is in our head. Okay, sorry.
Okay.
Is that page 144?
It's page, I don't know, page 3 in the PDF, which is page 143. Where he says, there are these two parts that we recognize in ourselves, the blind mechanical thing and then the spiritual thing with sight or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, he's on to something with that. And, you know, I think that one function that it serves, or one thing that, like, the organism experiences when it gets drunk, is that the functioning of the mind is altered. Right? I mean, altered states or what have you. And so when that, like, deeper part, the part that sees, recognizes, like, the conscious mind, if you will, or the mechanical part is, like, altered, I think that's a thing that is what the organism is destined to do. That's, like, its function, you know, self-transformation. And so
can
the conscious
say that again?
Part, whatever you... Yes. If there are these two parts,
right.
the mechanical blind part and the part that sees, the function of the organism is to transform the part that is mechanical so that it can express and be an instrument of the spiritual part that sees.
Right.
But the mechanical part, being mechanical, resists. It's like rigid, and we have our experience in ordinary whatever life where we fall into habits and we become like rigidified in the way we think and feel and so on, and we don't like develop and grow. We're in like a sort of a arrested development. You know, we develop enough to, like, walk around and whatever, not bump into things and get on with the day, but we don't develop our further capacities for, like, great creative genius. And so, like, the organism needs to realize that the mechanical part is, like, malleable if only you apply yourself to transform your whole person. And so when you get drunk, it's like the deeper part is kind of, this is my, you know, this is my thought here. The deeper part is basically like wanting the mechanical part to realize its malleability so that you can learn to, like, transform yourself. But the mechanical part just wants to use, like, external means. As Tolstoy says, you know, we have an external way of, like, achieving a certain end, and that's by just ingesting whatever, alcohol or cigarettes or some other drugs. And what that accomplishes is that it gives you an experience of being altered. But it's an experience
you're talking
that
this way
doesn't
last
really
when you're talking. Sorry.
Work. Okay. Okay.
Last week, I think you said something about this. You use this phrase, like, feeling of freedom. Do you remember this? Okay, never mind.
I did.
But at some point, if I recall, you said something like, when you're drunk, you sort of, like, feel free and, like, your inhibitions are gone. And so it's, like, that's the type of thing that we're searching for, and that's the feeling that we have once this transformation that you're talking about happens. But anyway, sorry to interrupt. And I want to say that there is another caller on the line. So, caller, we see that you're there, and let's just finish this thought, and then we'll take the call. But go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
Okay, so sorry for blathering on and on.
Not at all.
One last thought that related to college is that it may, again, I don't know, obviously. I know nothing. But, you know, it may be that the organism, so to speak, this person as a whole, like, is at a point in life where supposedly what is happening in college is that transformation and that, like, development into maturity, and where, like, your creative powers are supposed to be unleashed, which is what, like, education is supposed to do for you, is not really happening. It's not really having its intended effect. And so maybe the organism is, like, it's getting nervous. Like, it needs that transformative experience, and education that's supposed to deliver it is not. And so, just instinctively, it's like people avoid getting into, like, an indoctrination kind of education because it clamps them down even more instead of, like, unlocking them. And so it's a time when you ought to be growing, so to speak, and transforming by learning. And instead, that's not happening. So it's a time to, like, just induce it mechanically with alcohol. That doesn't really lead anywhere.
All right. And I just want to say, and then I will turn it over to you guys after I make this remark, and then I'll take the call. But I think one of the reasons why there's this disenchantment with the, quote, college experience is for reasons that Tolstoy alludes to on page 151. It's section 5, where he's talking about, and Jeff mentioned this bit before, where he's talking about intellectual labor. And here, actually, Tolstoy says at the bottom of page 151, physical labor is painful at first. Still more so is intellectual labor. And then he goes on to talk about writing at some point, and he said, you know, writing is necessarily laborious and slow, and the harsher the critic, the longer it takes. So I also think that people don't appreciate the amount of pain and time and patience that, quote, education really requires, and they think that, you know, the classroom is it, but it's really like sitting by yourself with a book in the library for hours. Like that kind of work, or sitting with a paper, that's where the real education and learning happens. And I just wanted to add that in. Erica, do you want to add anything to this conversation?
No, I think you guys did a pretty good job of summarizing and elaborating on what I said. But I just saw, I'm looking at the Tolstoy's article, and I saw, again, where he has this quote about, you can see this, precious pearl in the water, but you're scared to go in and get it. And so you keep stirring up the water so you can't see the bottom, and so you don't have to dive in. And I feel like that kind of has to do, too, with how I mentioned people are trying to find out who they are, but they're sort of scared to go on that journey and really see. And so they're making turbulence through drinking so that they don't really have to dive into that and find that pearl.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Nice. I guess what I have to add to this is that I definitely see within my peers and a lot of people that I talk to that they think that the classroom's it, that it's, they don't do the reading until it's time to take the exam, and then they cram or just do whatever. They go over the keywords, and they think that's all that needs to happen. And, I mean, sometimes I find myself getting into a routine with certain classes where I'm like, okay, I can get away with not doing the reading this time. So then the next time comes around and you're like, well, I got away with it last time, so maybe I'll just do it this next time. And then you find yourself getting into that routine. And I think that's what happens to a lot of college students with every college class and with college as a whole. By the time you're a senior, you're like, okay, it's time to get out of here. And then you reflect, you're like, wow, well, I have my classes and my experience with class changed a lot. And I think a lot of people feel no. But I know in my personal life, I can look back and, I mean, I'm fortunate because I have found certain classes where I enjoy going to class and learning and engaging in the material, and I find that with those classes, because of that pleasure, I actually do the reading, and then I do it once, and then I do it again, and every time I read it, I get more out of it, and I think that if people found more satisfaction in that, maybe they would lean less on alcohol. But then again, the question is, well, how do you do that for everybody? But with Tolstoy, I think that is also something that comes up within. So, I mean, I know I'm getting off on the tangent here, but...
it's a good tangent.
I just think that, I mean, I can, going back to my personal life, I can count on both of my hands, the classes that I've taken that have really meant something to me and stuck with me. And, I mean, I'm thankful that I did get that out of college, but... Yeah, I think that this disconnect with classes and also what Erica said, like muddying the waters as an excuse to not get into it. Mm-hmm. So I think this is all tied in. If you drink hard on the weekends and then you wake up on Monday and you're all hungover and you go into class and you're like, okay, well, I made it to class. At least I did that. Mm-hmm. And then so you find yourself falling into this animalistic habitual tendencies that I think Tolstoy is getting at.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay, I'm going to take this call. Caller, are you there? Hello?
Yes.
Caller?
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yes.
You're an ethics talk. Do you have a question about Tolstoy?
Question? Not exactly. Just feel like I feel like this kind of spoke to me when I saw it. I'm a Buddhist from a Catholic family who doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, and doesn't have sex. And I'm 20 years old, and I'm in the Navy. So I'm kind of my own person in that regard. But I was going to offer my opinion on why I agree with what Tolstoy was saying about even moderate drinking. Have I ever had something to drink before? Yes, but it's usually, it's very minimal alcohol, like a mimosa or something like that. And the only reason I ever did have those drinks was because I like the taste of the drink itself. If I could have that without the alcohol, I choose to. I've never been drunk. I've never been tipsy. And I think the reason for these in society and in especially in college is that people are finding internal difficulties and solving them externally, because that's the easy way. Someone gets a headache, they take an Advil. I find it's always the same, even with drinking, with cigarettes, with marijuana, with a plethora of things. And some people will argue that, well, I'm not upset, I'm not depressed, I don't have problems in my life. This just makes me feel better, or this just I feel looser, or I have more fun when I do that. Well, that to me is a problem, that you need to have something external to fix those, you don't feel like you're reaching your potential in those areas until you think that these things will help. But you're still not reaching those potentials. You're, something else is. Alcohol is. Cigarettes are, you know. And so that's where I think that it's profoundly harmful, as Tolstoy says, to even moderately get drunk. And the being out of control of oneself is something that I don't really agree with either. That's one of the reasons why I'll never get drunk. I can never forgive myself if I were to do something because I was intoxicated, you know, because I chose to be intoxicated. So.
Right. So going back to this point that you said about you drink because you're trying to realize your potential, but you really don't. Tolstoy says something similar where he said, where he's talking about writing, and I don't know if any of you guys remember this passage, but I think he's actually mentioning this in connection with tobacco, but whatever, same point applies. And he says something like, you know, you may feel inclined to have a cigarette or have a drink because your thoughts are not coming to you. And he says, you know, and then you have a cigarette, and then it seems like your thoughts are coming to you. But in fact, that's what's not happening because you're not even in control of your thoughts.
Wow. Just like, I wrote it. That's
funny. Yeah. When you were talking about this, it sounded very similar. And so it's like the thing, like what you identify as realizing, quote, your potential is not at all. And Tolstoy goes on to say that, you know, it's this only with this real hard work of doing it without the substance, which is really what realizing your potential consists in.
Try to imagine throwing a party in college and not having any alcohol and making it a blast. Try to imagine that. Try to imagine, you know, something that would be considered extremely difficult, I think, by most people, you know. And that goes for most things that involve alcohol or cigarettes, you know. Try and have fun and let loose and let your inhibitions go away without something else. You know, most people can't do it. And I think the reason for that, actually, is because most of your inhibitions are there for a reason, you know. Like the people who get drunk and then become insanely promiscuous, you know, and then blame it on being drunk. Well, you know, those inhibitions were there for a reason, and you drank to get rid of your inhibitions, and then, you know, it's just a little cycle, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Wow, really insightful comments. And I just want to say, you know, to this question, like, imagine having a party without alcohol. And I just wanted to say that one of my most pleasurable times with you guys, you, Jeff, and Erica, was at the Peace Palace when we did that. I mean, there was no alcohol involved, and we were at the Peace Palace in The Hague, and we were singing and dancing without alcohol in a public place. And it was, for me, you know, very joyful and childlike and a great memory. And I cannot say that I even remember times when I've drank and danced and so forth like that. So hear to your comments. And yeah, I think it's like this norm that we have, and we just don't even think about doing things without alcohol.
I'm sure there's some disagreements, but I haven't heard any with me.
Yeah. Does anybody disagree? What, do you want to say what your name is?
Taylor Michael.
Taylor, okay. Taylor Michael, thank you. Does anybody disagree with Taylor Michael?
No, I think he did a really good job. And, like, everything he says is, you should call in more often. You're doing really well.
it's not easy in the Navy. But yeah.
Mike, are you still there?
I am still here.
Do you disagree?
No, I'm down with it, man. I mean, I think you're on point, and, yeah, definitely, you know, the learning experience that you give up by spending your time getting drunk instead of working hard and enduring the pain that is necessary is like a ridiculous exchange, you know what I'm saying?
I agree.
And, yeah, learning is way more powerful. In fact, I mean, I don't know, learning it when you really, you know, power it up more and more is way better than drugs, man. Drugs are like cornflakes compared to philosophy. I'm serious. when it's, you know, it's the thing, Hope, that you had said that's so critical, that it's painful. I mean, it involves like hard work, but when you endure that, you know, more and more, the repercussion is more and more, you know, amazing insight and what have you, and it's transformative in a way that, like, remains and is positive. And alcohol or whatever, intoxication is like, you know, among whatever other elements there may be in different explanations, it's like a way that your organism experiences a change in its whole, like, way of functioning. But it's a change that's, like, not really beneficial, generally. And so, yeah, I don't know, you know, lately I've been studying really hard on Buddhism and, like, Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, and I'm pretty much tripping 24/7. It's, like, really powerful when you, you know, when your experience of just whatever, the ordinary consciousness is not the same as it was. That's, I think, the thing that the organism, it's not really like your conscious mind per se, but like the human being wants that and knows that it's like its calling to transform and like whatever, develop. And when it doesn't do that, it takes to other weird, you know, means to have that experience. And there's a passage that I know that you're fond of, Hope, by Aristotle, where he says something like, in politics, the reason people, like, do all sorts of mischievous things and break the law is because they're, like, lacking philosophy, basically. Like, because the organism wants, like, to understand and know and, like, illuminate itself. And when the conscious mind, for lack of a better term, is, like, making choices that are not in accord with, like, what the whole person wants, so to speak, it leads to all sorts of, like, internal conflict and all sorts of whatever, mischief.
Mm. And I would also add that going back to, like, this idea of what the organism wants and needs, one of my mantras is, you can't fool yourself. So, like, you know if you are, quote, actualizing your potential through alcohol on the one hand, or actualizing your potential through hard work on the other. Like, you can't fool yourself, and you see what you're doing. And when you see yourself working hard, and you keep working hard, and you see that, and you are a witness to that, that is, you know, really, I mean, I think there's a type of pleasure to that, that if you partake in it enough times, you know, there's this transformation that goes on. So it's like, we are, like, we need to see ourselves striving for something. And we know that when we're doing that, there's something real and true going on. And I just wanted to add that in there, that there's some sort of, like, self-perception aspect to this whole thing that we're talking about. And that there's like, a very specific type of pleasure involved in seeing yourself work hard. I have this phrase, it's a very specific hedonic. Hedone is the Greek word for pleasure. Hedonic cocktail. So it's like a mix of very specific pleasures, ideally. So I just wanted to throw that in, and I just want to say what a, you know, pleasure it is to have this conversation. And look at alcohol in a way that, you know, Tolstoy looked at it, and it's unfortunate that these conversations aren't as prevalent as we'd like them to be. So having said that, Taylor Michael, you have any closing remarks? Do you want to stay on the line?
Sure, I will. But in regards to some of the things that were said,
yeah, sure.
I think I'm just trying to put my thoughts together. I think that in regards to the self-actualization and things like that, Buddhism goes a lot into, you know, self-awareness and all that. And I think that despite what you said, I think that people are able to fool themselves, not just with alcohol, but, I mean, the mind can do anything, including, you know, fooling itself. And I see it every day. People who convince themselves that the things they're doing are right. And though it's been consistently and famously argued by philosophers and everyone else in the world that there is no right or wrong, I once did have a professor who was against altruism, said that it didn't exist because everything, I'm sure you're familiar with this, I don't remember which philosopher brought it up, that anything that you do for someone else, you ultimately do for yourself. You help the old lady across the street because you feel good about it. You sacrifice your life because or for your child because you're perpetuating your genes throughout time, or immortalizing yourself as a hero in people's eyes. And for the longest time, I just wanted to disagree with him, but I couldn't come up. Everything that I would say, he would just shoot down. You know, oh, well, that's for yourself. And it wasn't until I said, you know, you choose what you do to feel good about. You know, I was like, that was it for me. And I was like, you know, you choose to do something for someone. You choose to help the old lady across the street. You choose to give your life for someone else. You choose to do something good for the majority or for other people and feel good about that, as opposed to feeling good about raping or stealing or murdering someone or just doing something destructive. And so in the end, there is a choice that you're making there. And I think that falls into this drinking thing. I think that people who do choose to take the easy path, you know, Muhammad Ali said, suffer now and live the rest of your life as a champion. And that's been my motto. I'm trying to go to the Navy SEAL. So that's what I'm doing every day. I'm just like suffering every day, just tearing my body apart. And I really believe that lifestyle that's something that the SEALs themselves kind of carries the motto, the training never ends. It's never over. You never stop striving to better yourself. There is no finish line, no matter what. You know, even if you get to this goal that you've set for yourself, you have a new goal. You know, you die having a goal. Not to say that you've left your life unfinished or you've been wanting all your life and you've never been satisfied, but that feeling that you talked about of consistently having a pattern of working hard for something, accomplishing something, I think is not only something for the individual, but for society as a whole. You know, if we ever knew all the answers to the universe, everything, what would be the point, you know, to experience it in a blink and then go? I mean, maybe that would be fine, but most people like the idea of not knowing because they have something to work for. And I think that drugs, in a very vast sense, eliminates that drive, you know, in both the stereotypical, the pothead on the couch, and the drunk, passed out kind of, you know, image, and in the sense of it being a habitual thing. You know, you're habitually stopping yourself from succeeding, from doing something great, from getting high off of a sunrise because it's so beautiful, from really, you know, sitting there and seeing where you are and being able to see everything that you've seen. And so, I don't know, I kind of went pretty far on that one.
But, no, love it. Actually, Tolstoy, not so much in this piece, but in other pieces, this idea of this constant striving for self-perfection. Yeah, he's down with that. And
I think we would have gotten along quite well.
Yeah. I wish I had the passage in front of me. I don't. But I just wanted to say that at one point he says that this is like, he loses this in his life, and there's a very famous piece he's written called My Confessions, where he sort of lost this, and he was striving for a type of perfection, not the true type. It was the sort of material success and doing well socially and that notion of progress, and he was really miserable and almost killed himself. And he had this spiritual transformation where he said, you know, he really returned to who this childlike, this idea that he had as a child and as a youth, which is that there's something to be better for something and for himself. And he returns to this idea of spiritual perfection at the end of his life. In My Confessions, it's really beautiful. Okay, so excellent. Going back to the Stupefy piece, I thought it would be useful because we have like a half hour left to just kind of distill, like in one sentence, Tolstoy's main argument, main reason, because we've been talking about a lot here, but like in one sentence, and Erica, we'll start with you. So Tolstoy doesn't explicitly say, you know, this argument. He's explaining why people do drink, but within this discussion, one can pick out an argument why you shouldn't at all. And so, in one sentence or two, what did you come away with, Erica?
All right. In two sentences, I said that Tolstoy advocates complete abstinence because drinking distracts oneself from harmonizing their spiritual being with their physical being. Drinking allows a person to act without acknowledging or following their conscience, which is harmful for spiritual development.
Okay. So, anybody want to elaborate on that?
I think it's like pretty self-explanatory. It kind of goes back to what Mike was saying earlier about like the like physical, like mechanical being, and then like the like deeper spiritual being, and you have to like harmonize those together in order to function
right.
properly.
And yeah, there's definitely this idea of like there's this thing, there's conscience, he calls this conscience. Mm-hmm. There's conscience within you. And at one point in the essay, he says something like, this conscience, which is this, last week we were talking about this other voice in your head. we all have an idea of what he's talking about. But at one point he says, this doesn't really make itself known to you until you veer away from it. And he has this metaphor of like the needle on the compass, and it's always pointed northwards or something like this, and only when there's movement away from your center, if you will, do you, like, does it come out and do you see it? And so there's this thing in there, I'll call it conscience or center, true self, calling. This is like the pearl that you're talking about. And, right, the goal is to become one with that thing. And he says, life is not in sync with that. And there are two responses to it. And one is this, like, diverting your attention, and the other is deadening this pearl. And so there's this other thing in us that's there, and the goal is to live in accordance with it or whatever. And so when you drink, you are contributing to this lack of harmony between this pearl and your being and then your life. Yeah. Anybody want to say yay, nay?
I would just throw in one quote that I assume that he really is not stating this himself, per se, but he's voicing like what the person who tries to justify drinking feels like when he says on page 4 of the PDF, which is whichever page, life is not what it should be according to the demands of conscience. One cannot possibly turn one's life into conformity with its demands. Mm. And I think that is when people feel, insofar as his explanation of why people drink is right, when you feel like you don't know a way to get your life in order properly, you don't know a way to live in harmony with your, like, ultimate deepest self or whatever, that's like, you know, that would seem to be, like, the problem. You know that phrase people use, what is it, when you try to treat the disease by only curing the symptoms or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
To just stop drinking is not necessarily going to solve anything. it's to learn how to live in accord with your, like, ultimate deepest self and what have you, what path or in life or whatever you want to call it to take that would like fulfill your ultimate nature. And yeah, when you no longer feel like what he says in that one line, one cannot possibly turn one's life into conformity with the demands of conscience, you realize that by hard work, maybe it's you can. And that's mm-hmm. when you can give up the other means to just blind yourself and try to forget and muddy up the waters and not see it or whatever.
Mm. I would also...
And so maybe it's like, maybe just one last sentence. It's just lack of culture, man. That culture is supposed to provide that for people, I think, ultimately, whatever. And it's like when it's corrupted and people don't know how to, like, live in a way that's, like, spiritually fulfilling, then they just degenerate into doing, like, these other things because they don't know what to do.
Hmm. Building off on that, in addition to this, like, not knowing how to live in accordance with your true self, and that's why people drink, so it sounds like the reason why people drink is because they don't know. I also think that there's a suggestion in this essay that it's this disharmony itself, which is why. So there's two, there's like the lack of knowledge, right? I don't know how to do it, so I'm going to drink. But there's also this discordance between this self and my life, and there's like there's something not jibing, and me no likey that. So I just want to like get. It's like having a contradiction. You get rid of one of the contradictions, one of the contradictory sentences, and so you don't have the tension anymore. And so then that's what drinking does. It drowns out. So there's not this tension that's apparent. So perhaps for the same thing, but we're going to have a party because there's another caller on the line,
nice.
So I might as well just
add him in.
Add him into the mix. Caller, are you there? Okay. Caller? 616? No? Okay. Well, should you muster up the courage... You're online. The microphone is illuminated. Anybody want to elaborate on this part about the disharmony that Erica's talking about?
I don't know.
Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Yes, I'm here. This is Joe.
Oh, okay. Just hold on a second, Joe, while Jeff gets his two cents, and then we'll get to you.
Can you hear me? I don't know if I'm.
Yes,
I'm
I can.
On.
Can you guys
okay.
hear him?
Yep.
Yep. We
yes,
can hear
this
you.
This is Joe. Yes.
Okay. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Just
Hi.
Hi. Hold tight.
I wanted to.
And
okay.
Jeff is in the middle of a thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This discordance that we're talking about, I think that it fleshes out, especially in the college life, of what we've been talking about, like seeking fulfillment and feeling good about yourself. And I think that drinking is almost like a temporary relief. You might drink and go out and have a good time, but that's it. There's nothing beyond that, and it's not self-actualized like we've been saying. It's not a product of your work. It's a product of leaning on something else, like leaning on a crutch, and that's never as satisfying as doing it on your own. I mean, you can think of, I mean, personally, you know, I've been given cars in my past. I mean, just to break it down to this, it's a very simple metaphor, but I was given a car and I didn't appreciate it because it was given to me, and then I went out and bought a car, and now I treat that car a lot different because I bought it with my own money. I went out and I had to go through all the loans and signing all the papers and picking it out, so it became a lot more special to me, and I think that that can translate into this difference between, you know, learning and putting in the hard work and being self-actualized in that way versus a temporary pleasure of drinking alcohol. And I think that that pleasure that we seek is just confused when people try and seek it using alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, like the hard work, that's the good pleasure that people, unfortunately, especially in college, when with their classes, just aren't finding.
And if I can say real quick, too, about this, like, pleasure that you get from, like, doing something yourself, like, that's for you. And I feel like a lot of times the drinking is, like, comes about from peer pressure or just like feeling like you're supposed to do it, and like ultimately when you're doing that, you're doing it for others. Like you're doing what like others are making you feel like you should do, whereas when you're like doing hard work and doing something that you enjoy and learning and growing as a person intellectually and spiritually, like that's just for you. Like they're not, I mean, maybe they'll get something out of it, out of the future work or the successes that you have down the road, but like at that point in time it's making you happy, whereas when you're out drinking with other people, I think it makes them happy, too, because then they're not the only ones doing it. So, it like, you feed off of each other when you're drinking, and that feeling of, like, having – it's a pressure that satisfies other people as well, not just you.
Mm-hmm. Good point. All right, we do have another caller that'll patch in after Joe. Joe, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. Do you want to say anything?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think there's another aspect to drinking, which is, you know, in what you're talking about, it's a social, I would say in college, a social norm that's taken to excess. And I don't think it's completely, you know, there is some merit to it. In a lot of cultures that have been very old, they have wine festivals. They drink. It's very specific. They have rules, and it's a communal thing. In college, those rules have broken. They're not there. I mean, it's just who can get really wasted. So I think there can be a positive aspect to this bonding with alcohol that it has, you know, but it's done in a very systematic, you know, very ritualistic way, much the same way that, like, American Indians might use some of their, you know, their psychotropic drugs or whatever they're using. So I think we have to be careful about how you define the type of use. When I think of college drinking, I think of binge drinking, which just inherently is bad for you, you know. Mm-hmm. But can we say that to just one or two drinks? Because in my culture, I'm Jewish, and we look at alcohol as more like a food. It's really surprised me how many people outside of, you know, in a different religions, they had completely different views on alcohol versus how we were. And I can say there weren't that many alcoholics that I knew in there, but in some of these other religions, it was a lot higher from just my own, you know, cursory observations. So, you know, the way there's a lot of this background stuff too that goes along with drinking.
Because sure. And
one
I think
of the things when you're drinking, I just want to finish up.
Please,
is that you're making yourself vulnerable to other people. You can be taken advantage of very easily. So there's a certain amount of trust. And if you're in a group where you don't trust them and you're drinking, you're very vulnerable and it's probably not pleasurable to you. So.
Good point. Okay, we have another caller, so I'm going to take that. All right, other caller who's been on hold. Are you there?
Is this caller from 561 area code? Because that's me, Hope.
No, this is 111111.
Okay.
It looks like it's perhaps Skype. But no, yeah, I know you're there, Mike.
Okay.
I thought that you dropped and you called in from your other phone. But no, this is somebody.
You mind
else.
If I respond to Joe?
Go ahead.
I understand what you're saying, but I kind of think that, and this is just my view on it, I think that making, not that it hasn't worked for other people, and not that it can't be bettered, but I think that making alcohol, or anything for that matter, anything material, a bond in the sense of, you know, we come together, you know, we all drink and stuff like that. You know, in a perfect world, that would probably work. That would be great. You know, everyone has a toast, everyone takes a drink, and that's it. But more often than not, causing that kind of atmosphere, the idea, like instilling that idea that, you know, we're coming together to drink. What happens to the people, you know, who don't drink? And I'm sure that in those cultures, you know, some people just don't do it. But you see what I'm saying with the peer pressure. And not everyone is a strong mind. There's a lot of people who would feel the need even more so to drink who wouldn't have had it not been part of the bonding experience. I think people need to learn to bond with people. People need to learn to talk to people. And as she stated earlier, to have fun and dance and let go and be like a child sometimes without anything external involved whatsoever. You know, they need to be able to reach down and be comfortable with themselves enough to where all of those things are as unnecessary as they really are. So.
Well said. Okay, before we switch gears with 10 minutes left, any final thoughts on this disharmony that Erica brought up with her summation of the argument? Okay, so let's move to Jeff. And you came away with something a little bit different in terms of your summation of Tolstoy.
So when I was reading the piece, I really got the consequences. I feel like that he came from a very consequentialist standpoint. So to quote him, I think that one of the quotes that really sums up how he feels the consequences of drinking play out is on page 143. He says, "Moreover, the use of these things, alcohol, is manifestly injurious, producing terrible evils known and confessed by everyone, causing the destruction of more human beings than have perished in all wars and contagious diseases together." Mm. So, I mean, from that statement right there, it seems that he views alcohol as necessarily having bad consequences. So, and what I summarize it as any drinking makes the conscious less able to effectively regulate the animal or physical actions. Thus, drinking makes immoral action more likely, and according to Tolstoy, the consequences will always be negative or horrible, as he puts it. So that's what I came away with.
Cool. And so Jeff used this phrase, consequentialist, and for those of you who are not philosophy students or study philosophy formally, we would like to, in the remaining moments, just try to make a quick distinction between three different moral frameworks. And one way to think about this is, you know, philosophers disagree with each other as to what, given a complex scenario, are the morally relevant factors. So is it the consequences of something? Is it the duties of somebody? Is it the character traits? So on and so forth. So in any case, I want to turn it over to Mike Russo to, if you could, Mike, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Could you just quickly explain the difference between consequentialism on the one hand and then like deontology on the other?
Well, your setup made it very easy because, in effect, I mean, you sort of just did.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, well said. that the consequentialist point of view is that, you know, what counts or matters from a moral point of view in terms of an action is its consequences, and generally speaking, you know, whether the consequences of an action maximize pleasure or well-being for people, that would make the action good. And if it does not do so, or if the consequences of an action are harmful to people, you know, all else being equal, such an action would be, you know, morally bad, or its moral value would be negative. Whereas deontology is the view that the moral worth of an action really originates in the principles of duty that one must follow, and the maxims, as Kant says, who's probably like the prime deontological philosopher. It's the maxims of your action, or the principles of action that you sort of affirm by acting, that really are what define the moral value of the action and like doing your duty. Whereas virtue ethics, which would really be represented, so to speak, by Aristotle, is of the point of view that it's less about principles and maxims of action, which sound a lot like rules and so forth about like what should be done, and moral worth and so forth, and the concern of like moral philosophy is really character. The virtue of character, because, and I think there's like, you know, not that it's any knockdown refutation of deontology, but there's like a principled reason, I think, for accepting virtue ethics, which is that there aren't really any sort of set of rules or instructions that can always be followed, or that are directly and simply applicable in all circumstances. And so that in order to, like, live well and be good and be moral, you would have to be of a certain character. It has to be something about, like, the kind of person that you are and not just following the right, you know, instructions. And so what you ought to be concerned with in terms of, like, morality is the development of virtue in yourself.
Cool. Awesome. To build off on these distinctions. Is that the right phraseology? Build off on? Doesn't sound right. Anyway.
Works.
So, Jeff, you were talking about the consequences, these injurious effects and so forth. And one thing I want to just make apparent is, you know, when we're making these distinctions between consequentialism, deontology, and virtue ethics, it's not as if, you know, the question is, what is Tolstoy? What is his real beef here with alcohol? And Tolstoy can say, yeah, alcohol does have bad consequences, but that's not they're not morally relevant. I've heard this made, actually it's Nancy Sherman's book, Mike, I know you have this, Making a Necessity of Virtue, and she's talking about Kant, and she says, look, it's not like Kant doesn't realize that certain actions may make you happy and may give you pleasure, but that has nothing to do, that has no moral relevance. It's very nice, but it's just morally irrelevant. And so the question that I would like to address is, what is it that's really morally relevant for Tolstoy here? And I just want to draw our attention to some passages where it does, in fact, sounds like, to me, he's really talking about a kind of like real duty to ourselves, and that if we violate this duty, these bad consequences happen. But the real harm is this breach of duty to ourselves. And so if you look on page 149, at the very bottom, it's the last full paragraph, and he says, "The chief work which moves the whole life of a man proceeds not in the motion of arms and legs, the physical powers, but in the consciousness." So it's like man has this primary task that has to do with his consciousness. And then on page 151, two pages over, he says, "We must," this is the first full paragraph, "we must, as far as in us lies, try to place ourselves and others in such conditions that the clearness and delicacy of the thoughts necessary for the regular work of the conscience may not be disturbed." And not to do the opposite by trying to make this work of the conscience more difficult and troublesome by the use of stupefying things. So to me it sounds like he's saying our duty. And what came to me, has anybody seen the movie Steel Magnolias?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Well, even if you haven't seen it, I'm sure you've seen a movie where there's a family and a beloved is like in the hospital in a coma, and then their beloved is sitting at the side of the bed like hours just waiting for that moment when they wake up. Because they want to be there if their beloved opens their eyes. They don't want the beloved to open the eyes and there to be no one there. And so when I read this passage, I was thinking of that, because it's almost like there's this thing in us and we have to be there all the time and ready and waiting and attentive, so that if it decides to make itself there, we can see it. And we have to make sure that our conditions are such that we're able to see it when it's there and not drink and smoke so that this thing doesn't appear to us. And so we have to sort of prepare the conditions. So to me, I saw this as like a real deontological. I think there's also a virtue theoretic character aspect that he's talking about as well, but I'll just open it up to anybody. I know there's a lot of people on the line right now. So somebody, if you feel compelled, jump right in.
I'm a little compelled, and I'll be very brief and not blather on.
Okay.
That was beautiful, Hope. Awesome, man.
Uh-huh.
Hell yeah, damn.
You mean the Steel Magnolias part?
Yeah, that part in particular, I mean. And I mean, it relates back to what I had said before about, you know, the mechanical part or conscious mind or whatever you want to call it, you know, it does not cooperate with, like, the whole person and the deeper part. And it that's what it needs to be transformed into, a thing that is mm-hmm. prepared to follow the light of the conscience or whatever you want to call it. And that's what the total person like wants from it, but it's like off doing something else, or it just doesn't know, or whatever you want to say. And your image right there was really beautiful, actually, of wanting to, you know, there needs to be something there when it like comes, wakes up. And that's the conscious mind needs to like be there and ready, and it isn't. And I think your description there nicely blended like all three of those kind of theories, because you said you have a duty to yourself and the consequences of drinking are that you fail in that duty. So that's all of them right there. You have the duty and the consequences are that it harms your character.
Mm-hmm.
Virtue, deontology, consequences,
yeah.
Kind of all.
And also going back to Taylor Michael's remark, 60 seconds left, last. This whole idea of, you know, habituating yourself to, drink before you do the hard thing. Like you're forming this character where you're avoiding the real effort and taking the easy way out, and that's a formation of a bad character trait, I would say. Well, any last words? I'll be quiet. 30 seconds left, anybody?
Good show.
Illuminating.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, well, read this piece more than once. I've read it 4 times, and I think I'm just starting to get it. I want to read it again. But actually, next week we'll be addressing this point, Mike, that you said that there's no rules that one could follow at all times or something.
Right.
One question is a rule against genocide an exception to that claim? And we're going to be talking about Nuremberg next week, the Nuremberg trials. If you don't know, they were the first trials of crimes against humanity and so forth. And so that's next week's show. So you've been listening to Ethics Talk. Thank you, everybody who's called in. It was a real great show. And please call next week, and we'll see you in a week. Good night.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.